Isaiah 56 verse 7 reads, "Even them will I bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices shall be accepted upon mine altar, for mine house shall be called a house of prayer for all people." Good morning. Our class this morning is on Herod's temple and what little information there is extant about it. First, it must be understood that this holy mountain where David made an offering, where Solomon's temple was built, where the returned exiles rebuilt, where Herod rebuilt, and where now stands a Muslim shrine where all these structures were built, Abram first offered up Isaac. From Genesis 22, we read, "And it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham and said unto him, Abraham, and he said, Behold, here I am. And he said, Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. And Abraham rose up early in the morning, and saddled his ass, and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and clave the wood for the burnt offering, and rose up, and went into the place of which God had told him." This holy mountain, where now stands the structure, the Dome of the Rock, was purchased by David, whereon he built an altar. From 2 Samuel we read, "And Gad came that day to David and said unto him, Go up, rear an altar unto the Lord in the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. And David, according to the saying of Gad, went up as the Lord commanded, and all these things did Araunah," excuse me, we're jumping down to verse 23, "all these things did Araunah as a king give unto the king. And Araunah said unto the king, The Lord thy God accept thee. And the king said unto Araunah, Nay, but I will surely buy it of thee at a price. Neither will I offer burnt offerings unto the Lord my God of that which dost cost me nothing. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. And David built there an altar unto the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings." Now, the historian Flavius Josephus, commenting on David's sacrifice on the threshing floor of Araunah, had this to say, "And when Araunah said he would do as he pleased, he bought the threshing floor of him for 50 shekels. And when he had built an altar, he performed divine service and brought a burnt offering, and offered peace offerings also. With these God was pacified, and became gracious to them again. Now it happened that Abraham came and offered his son Isaac for a burnt offering at this very place. And when the youth was ready to have his throat cut, a ram appeared suddenly which Abraham sacrificed instead of his son. Now when David saw that God had heard his prayer and had graciously accepted his sacrifice, he resolved to call that entire place the altar of the people and to build a temple to God there. Before we consider our focus this morning, Herod's temple and the mount, let us review briefly the original structure that was built by Solomon some 3,000 years ago. From 1 Kings chapter 5, Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servants unto Solomon, for he had heard that they had anointed him king in the room of his father, for Hiram was ever a lover of David. And Solomon sent to Hiram, saying, Thou knowest how that David, my father, could not build an house unto the name of the Lord his God, for the wars which were about him on every side, so that there is neither adversary, Thou knowest how that David, my father, could not build an house unto the name of the Lord his God, for the wars which were ever about him on every side, until the Lord put them under the soles of his feet. But now the Lord my God hath given me rest on every side, so that there is neither adversary nor evil occurrent. And behold, I propose to build an house unto the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord spake unto David my father, saying, Thy son, whom I will set upon thy throne in thy room, he shall build a house unto my name. Again, we refer to Josephus, wherein he writes, Now therefore, the king laid the foundations of the temple very deep into the ground, and the materials were strong stones, as such as would resist the force of time. Indeed, these were to unite themselves with the earth and become a basis for a sure foundation for that superstructure which was to be erected over it. They were to be so strong in order to sustain with ease those vast superstructures and precious ornaments whose own weight was to be not less than the weight of those other high and heavy buildings which the king designed to be very ornamental and magnificent. Now, we do read just how magnificent Solomon's structure or construction projects were, as we read of the Queen of Sheba's visit to Jerusalem. From 1 Kings. And when the Queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to prove him with hard questions. And she came to Jerusalem with a very great train, with camels that bear spices, and very much gold, and precious stones. And when she was come to Solomon, she communed with him of all that was in her heart. And Solomon told her all her questions. There was not anything hid from the king, which he told her not. And when the queen of Sheba had seen all Solomon's wisdom, and the house that he had built, and the meat of his table, and the sitting of his servants, and the attendance of his ministers, and their apparel, and his cupbearers, and his ascent by which he went up into the house of the Lord, there was no spirit in her. And she said to the king, it was a true report that I heard in mine own land of thy acts and of thy wisdom. We might say, it took her breath away. It was so magnificent. This is a representation of what Solomon had built. Well, that was all destroyed 400 years later by the army of Nebuchadnezzar in 586 B.C. So from 2 Kings we read, and it came to pass in the 9th year of his reign, in the 10th month, in the 10th day of the month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came, he and all his host against Jerusalem, and pitched against it. And they built forts against it round about. And the city was besieged unto the 11th year of King Zedekiah. And on the 9th day of the 4th month, the famine prevailed in the city, and there was no bread for the people of the land. And in the 5th month, on the 7th day of the month, which is the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came Zaradan, captain of the guard, a servant of the king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem. And he burnt the house of the Lord and the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem, and every great man's house burnt he with fire. And all the army of the Chaldees that were with the captain of the guard break down the walls of Jerusalem round about. How much destruction did the army of Nebuchadnezzar do to Jerusalem? We read from Nehemiah, and I went out by night by the gate of the valley, even before the dragon well, and to the dung port, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and the gates thereof were consumed by fire. Then I went on to the gate of the fountain, and to the king's pool, but there was no place for the beast that was under me to pass. Then went I up in the night by the brook and viewed the wall and turned back and entered by the gate of the valley and so returned. And the rulers knew not whether I went or what I did, neither had I as yet told it to the Jews, nor to the priests, nor to the nobles, nor to the rulers, nor to the rest that did the work. Then said I unto them, ye see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lieth waste, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Come, and let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, that we be no more a reproach. Well, they rebuilt the wall, and eventually they rebuilt the temple. Well, the temple built by Solomon was truly a magnificent structure. The temple that was rebuilt by Zerubbabel, while roughly speaking the same footprint, was not as grand as the former. Not as grand as Solomon's. And so we read from Haggai, chapter 2, speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, and to the residue of the people, saying, "Who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing? It fell far, far short of what Solomon's temple was like." Okay. Please note that the footprint of Zerubbabel's rebuilt temple complex was approximately 500 cubits square. 500 this way, 500 that way. Which in feet would be approximately 800 feet square. We use the royal cubit, which was 21 inches. And while Mount Moriah, where Abraham offered up Isaac, where David offered up and built an altar and offered up, Mount Moriah was not level. Not level. Not level enough to accommodate a structure 800 feet square. Much dirt and rock debris was brought in as fill. Now, just for perspective, we can imagine if they want to build some structure or some place somewhere, they would bring in heavy earth-moving equipment, and they'd haul in dirt, and they'd haul in rock, and they'd level it all off, and it'd be done. They didn't have heavy earth-moving equipment. The skyline of Jerusalem in 37 B.C., when Herod the Great became king, was dominated by the second temple, which was rebuilt by Zerubbabel. Now, there are several pieces of information that must be entered at this time. Several of you, I know, have been to Jerusalem, Israel, so you know what I'm talking about. When you approach Jerusalem from the west, you cannot immediately see the Golden Dome, which stands over the ancient summit of Mount Moriah. As much of Jerusalem's recent construction is built on the western slope of a higher precipice than Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah is surrounded by two valleys. So when Abraham took Isaac up to Mount Moriah to offer him there, they had to climb approximately 200 feet. Even the Mount of Olives looks down upon the Golden Dome. Mount of Olives, which is on the east. Also, while the platform upon which Solomon built, being a square, was elongated on the south somewhat during the Hasmonean dynasty, approximately 100 years before Herod was even born. With those notes in mind, we shall consider the work of Herod the Great. This man, Herod the Great, it was he who sought to take the life of the newborn baby Jesus. We note this in Matthew 2. Then Herod, when he saw that he was mocked by the wise men, was exceeding wroth, and sent forth and slew all the children that were in Bethlehem, and in all the coasts thereof, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had diligently inquired of the wise men. Herod the Great, He was the son of Antipater of Idumea, appointed king of Judea by the Roman Senate at the suggestion of Antony, and maintained Roman support all his life. In those 37 years of his reign, he set out on an extremely ambitious construction campaign. When he became king of Judea, it was his intention to restore the skyline of Jerusalem to its original glory, Solomon's glory. We find these words of Herod as recorded by Josephus. Our fathers, indeed, when they were returned from Babylon, built this temple to God Almighty. Yet, because they worked under the constraints of Cyrus and Darius, who determined the measure of its rebuilding, they had not the opportunity to follow the original model, nor raise it to its ancient altitude. Now, by God's will, I am your governor. And since I have had peace a long time, and have gained great riches and large revenues, and what is the principal thing of all, I am at amity with and well regarded by the Romans. These are the words of Herod the Great. Herod undertook many building projects, among which were the fortress at Masada, the fortress at Herodium, the harbor of Caesarea, but his most famous task was to enlarge the platform or the level area upon which the temple was situated and remodel the temple itself, where it once was approximately 500 square cubits. When we use the royal cubit, which equals 21 inches, as we mentioned earlier, then our measurements are translated into 875 feet square. Now, after Herod's modifications, including a new western wall, we have a platform of, on the north, 1,038 feet. On the east, 1,530 feet. On the south, 914 feet. And on the west, 1,590 feet. This enlargement would more than double the size of the original. And for some kind of perspective, if this is to scale, then this right here is a playing football field. 100 yards long, 50 yards wide from the playing field. This was what Herod constructed. Consider this way. Playing surface of a football field is 54,000 square feet. Herod made the Temple Mount platform, 1.5 million square feet. This platform, then, as big as it was, this was approximately in the middle. On this platform, more or less in the center, was an enlarged temple. While the temple rebuilt by Zerubbabel was a relatively simple structure, the enlargements of Herod consisted of many rooms, side chambers, upper rooms, and stone staircases. It is important to note that while all this was being modified, remodeled, rebuilt, temple service was not affected. This, plus the enlarging of the Temple Mount platform, took approximately 40 years. So Herod did not see it completed when he died. Indeed, by some accounts, the work begun by Herod the Great was barely finished by his successor when Titus and the Romans began their siege in AD 70. While the holy place of Solomon's temple was a cube, the Holy of Holies remodeled by Herod was a square room with very high ceilings, estimated to be at twice the width, making that room a double cube. By that I mean a cube on top of a cube. We know from Scripture that the most holy place was separated from the holy by a veil. Indeed, that veil is an artist's rendition of the veil. The text accompanied by that photograph says it was 35 feet wide. That may or may not be true. It is, as you can see, it's twice as high as it is wide. The text also gave us this information. That it was so large, this veil was so large that it took 30 priests to carry it and a set of pulleys to raise it to the top. We happen to know from Scripture that veil, when Christ died on the stake, was rent in two from top down. As to the many rooms that Herod added, there is some interesting thought that we mention. Jesus said in John 14, this is not the quote, Jesus said, "In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you, I go to prepare a place for you." Well, it is our understanding of this passage, it is not the same as of apostate religion. But there is, based upon first the natural and then the spiritual, an interesting natural application to consider. On the north side of the new construction were rooms, one of which was the sheep room. Now, according to the law, sacrificial lambs must be examined for defects and then held overnight before being offered in sacrifice. As we know from the gospel accounts, when Jesus was arrested in Gethsemane, he was taken by the cover of darkness to the court of Caiaphas, the high priest. We know from the gospel accounts that they brought Jesus in cover of darkness. From Matthew 26, verse 57, we read, "And they that had laid hold on Jesus led him away to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled." And then in chapter 27, verse 1, this is the important part I'm trying to make here. He was taken from Garden of Gethsemane to the court of the high priest in the cover of darkness. But then, in Matthew 27, 1, when the morning was come, all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. And when they had bound him, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor. Was Jesus kept in one of these side rooms until daylight, when they were able to take him across the courtyard to be questioned by Pilate and ultimately crucified? We think so. Thus fulfilling the type so many times performed by the priest according to law. There is no consensus as to where Caiaphas held court, but most of the maps or models of first century Jerusalem place the house of Caiaphas, Herod's fortress, and Herod's palace in the upper city. That is immediately to the west of the temple platform, and it must be noted that all of these places had direct access to the temple platform via what archaeologists have labeled Wilson's Arch. Traditionalists believe that the Antonia Fortress, that which was on the northwest corner of Herod's Temple Mount complex, was the site of Pilate's praetorium or court, where Jesus was tried for blasphemy. Now, it is the opinion of most that Antonia Fortress was located adjacent to the northwest corner, outside of the temple complex, but adjacent to the temple platform. And some research dictates Antonia Fortress has included in its construction several towers whereby Roman guards would have a favorable advantage with which to overlook the entire temple complex. This was also barracks wherein were housed the Roman guard, and also where the Roman governor had his residence. Tradition, however, states otherwise and has the governor residing at Herod's palace, with the judgments carried immediately outside in the open courtyard. Since the historical record is mightily biased on apostate influence, it makes better sense to me, that if all the events and locales of the several trials were held at or near the temple complex, crowd control would be made easier. Crowd control was a real issue with the Romans. The reasons for this are quite simple, as we read in the 26th chapter of Matthew. Then assembled together the chief priests and the scribes and the elders of the people unto the palace where the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and consulted that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him. But they said, not on the feast day, lest there be an uproar among the people. In John's account of the final words of Pilate, we read, and from henceforth, Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, saying, if thou let this man go, thou art not Caesar's friend. Whosoever maketh himself a king speaketh against Caesar. When Pilate heard that saying, he brought Jesus forth, and sat down in the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, but in the Hebrew, Gabbatha. Thayer defines the word Gabbatha as being the raised platform in the room where the Sanhedrin met, a place on the temple platform adjacent or possibly a part of the complex which would not be violated by commoners. Now we're going to back up here. You can't see the labels here, but there was room, area for the Gentiles outside the temple itself. There was space in for discussion or the courtyard, if you will. We know that it would not have been in here. So we suspect that this was probably these might have been Caiaphas's offices or something. We don't know, but it makes sense. Having said that, there would not be violated, this hearing would not be violated by the common Jewish people. Now, it was no secret that Pilate and Caiaphas cared not for each other. And for this reason, we strongly believe that why Caiaphas' residence was outside with direct access to the temple, Pilate was located close to the, well, actually in Antonia's fortress. So they were separated. They would not have been living close together, as some suggest. That wouldn't have happened. Indeed, the whole process of Jesus' conviction was a chess game between Pilate and Caiaphas. It would no doubt be plausible that these final moments would be at or near to where Pilate resided at the chagrin of the high priest. Also, apostate tradition has made the last stages of Jesus' trial and the going out to Calvary an absolute travesty, which they call the stages of the cross. We cannot find any such reference in any of the gospel accounts, with the exception of that when the final words were spoken by Pilate, Jesus was led away. Luke declares that they immediately laid hold on one Simon a Cyrenian to carry the stake. Having said then, we return to the structure which was the crowning achievement of Herod the Great. The skyline of Jerusalem would be this. The skyline of Jerusalem, as Jesus and his band of faithful followers approached from the east, was dominated by the newly renovated temple, and Jesus wanted to celebrate Passover as he gazed upon its magnificence. We read then from Luke. If thou hadst known, even thou, at least in this thy day, the things which belong unto thy peace, but now they are hid from thine eyes, for the days shall come upon thee that thine enemies shall cast a trench about thee. And when he was come near, he beheld the city and wept over it. This from Luke 19, verse 41. 44. And shall lay thee even with the ground and thy children within thee, and they shall not leave thee one stone upon another, because thou knowest not the time of thy visitation. Jesus made his way to the temple, and we read of the confrontation he had with the changegoers, money changers. Matthew 21. And Jesus went into the temple of God and cast out all them that sold and bought in the temple, and overthrew the tables of the money changers and the seats of them that sold doves. Unto them he said, it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but ye have made it a den of thieves. Jumping down, our next verse, 14. And the blind and the lame came to him in the temple. Another note. When we read in the scripture, this took me a long time to figure this out, but that's me. When it says in the temple, at the temple, two different things. Jesus would never, ever, ever have gone in there. Why not? He was not a Levite. Temple Mount, courtyard of the Gentiles, possibly even to the into the courtyard there within the walls, but never, never, ever, ever into the temple. Okay. We read from John. And the Jews' Passover was at hand, and Jesus went up to the temple, up to Jerusalem, and found in the temple temple area, those that sold oxen and sheep and doves, and the changers of money sitting. And the disciples remembered that it was, this verse 17, and the disciples remembered that it was written, the zeal of thine house hath eaten me up. Then answered the Jews and said unto him, what sign showest thou unto us, seeing that thou doest these things? And Jesus answered and said unto them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Then, in verse 20, then said the Jews, 46 years it was in the building. Wilt thou rear it up in 3 days? But he spake of the temple of his body. Herod used mostly local limestone for construction. First order of business was to enlarge the temple platform, which he did. This he did with blocks of stone. Some of you that have been in, went to Jerusalem might have had the opportunity to see some of these walls. Some of the stones were 40 feet long, 16 feet in width, 10 feet high. It has been said that the whole project has been barely completed when it was destroyed by Titus. It is also believed that the exposed stones of the temple itself, were faced with a white porcelain glaze, which in the early morning sunlight would be most brilliant to look upon. When Jesus came into the temple, we read from Matthew, the chief priests and the elders of the people came unto him as he was teaching and said, by what authority dost these things? And who gave thee this authority? We read again in Mark, as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples said unto him, Master, we see what manner of stones and what building are here. Jesus replied, seest thou those great buildings? There shall not be left one stone upon another. Jesus was not the only individual in the scriptures to have an encounter at the temple, if you will. We read in Acts, now when Peter and John went up together into the temple at the hour of prayer being the ninth hour, a certain man, lame from his mother's womb, was carried, whom they daily at the gate of the temple, which is called Beautiful, to ask alms of them that entered into the temple. We read that when the man was healed, he joyfully embraced Peter and John with thanksgiving. The porch, or part of the entrance to the court of the woman itself, was immediately before the Beautiful, or Eastern Gate, close proximity. We also read of Paul in the temple in Acts 21. Then Paul took the men and the next day purified himself with them, entered into the temple to signify the accomplishment of the days of purification until that an offering should be offered for every one of them. And when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews which were of Asia, when they saw him in the temple, Paul could have been in the temple. He was a Pharisee. Stirred up all the people and laid hands on him. Not that Paul was there, but who did Paul take with him? As we noted on our architectural drawing of the temple, that there was a place for the Gentiles to assemble outside. Now, there is strong archaeological evidence that since Paul was, when he was rescued by the Roman soldiers, while he was being speaking to the Jews, he was on some stairs. Well, there is evidence of those stairs from Antonio Fortress down towards the upper city. Those stairs, some of those stairs still remain. It makes sense to me that Paul would be on those stairs speaking to the Jews in front of him, because the soldiers behind him on the stairs had his back. Well, Paul was directly taken to Rome, where he was beheaded by the order of Nero. Shortly after Paul's death, Judea was invaded by the might of the Roman army. Jerusalem was placed under siege, and ultimately the walls were breached, homes were burned, and the temple itself was stripped of all furnishings. Valuables were carried off to Rome, as depicted in the artwork on the face of the Arch of Titus. Gold was peeled off the doors and walls, and what could be burnt was burned. Flavius Josephus again. As legions charged in, the first part of the breaching was Antonia's fortress. As legions charged in, neither persuasion nor threat could check their impetuosity. Passion alone was in command. Crowded around entrances, many were trampled, many more were butchered. Where they were caught, the dead were piled up around the altar, and blood flowed like a river down the sanctuary steps. Slaughter of Jews. The account of Josephus described Titus as moderate in his approach. Indeed, had the Jews not used fire to inhibit the Roman advance through the Antonia fortress, the enraged Romans, might not have extended the spread to the fire in the temple itself. Josephus further remarks, "Now, as soon as the army had no more people to slay or plunder, they turned their attention to leveling the buildings that remained. It was the Roman desire to so totally destroy Jerusalem that passersby would not be aware that it was ever, ever inhabited. However, it was also their desire to leave standing the towers of Antonia Fortress, the towers on the extreme northeast corner of the Temple Mount. Leave the towers so that it might be a testament to the might of Rome." Josephus also claims that around 1 million were killed during the siege, and almost 100,000 were enslaved. This high number is believed by some to be grossly exaggerated, but it must be understood that this was Passover. Passover always swelled the population of Jerusalem, and the siege began just a few days before, on April 14, A.D. 70. Thus was the house of the Lord destroyed by fire. Again, it is interesting to note that most who have had the opportunity to look inside the Dome of the Rock have observed that while most of the summit of Mount Moriah is covered by a platform, the southern section is visible, and the area of natural rock is distinguishable from the fill that was placed there by Solomon. It is interesting to note that the Dome of the Rock is precisely, I believe, where Solomon's most holy place was probably situated. Now, it is our understanding, indeed part of our precious hope, that soon that profane golden dome will be destroyed, and ultimately a new house of prayer for all people will be built. Thank you.